I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jeb Powers.
Amen.
And I've been sober a little over 11 years, and I'm really honored to be here tonight. I want you to know that. To be asked to come up here with Vic and fill in for Rob, it's big shoes. I'm a big fan of Vic's and Rob's both. But, you know, I got to clear up a misconception that Rob gave you all last week if you all were here. He said that he was younger than Vic and I, and that's a lie. Vic and I are young people. Rob dyes his hair, he uses Botox, and he's had plastic surgery. He's not here to challenge that, and that's too bad, but I just wanted to clear that up. And something else, Vic just went through those different things that alcoholics do. We have fun, we make love, we fight, we do all these things. And so we could be all different things, but the one thing that we all have in common is when we put a drink in our body, we do one thing. We get another drink. And that's the one thing that real alcoholics do, is no matter how we react or no matter how we act when we drink, we always have that one common thing, is we look for another drink. I've got to tell you that I'm a little bit nervous, and I've asked God to speak through me tonight, so if you don't like what you hear, you can get your money back from Vic, or you can blame God. But you ain't blaming me, because I've turned this whole thing over. I don't know how to do this, really. And also something else. I'm different, okay? And I was different from the day I came in. I'm different now. I was 44 years old before I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I had no clue what Alcoholics Anonymous was. Both my grandfathers died from this disease. My parents did not talk about it. They were not alcoholics. I was raised in a really good family. So when my life was going out of control, when my body was shutting down, when I was urinating in the bed with my wife, and I was willing to give away my child, did somebody suggest that maybe I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, I'm not an alcoholic. I've been drinking for 35 years, every time I could get the chance, every day or night. And I'm not an alcoholic. I'm different. Okay? And you might hear that every now and then, and some of you might felt that way. I never have been to an emergency room for alcoholism. I've never been to a detox. I've never been to a treatment center. And I've never been to rehab. I've been to all those places sober. But I was never there when I was drinking. So how could I be an alcoholic? Alcoholics go to the emergency room. They go to detox. They have to be treated. They have to go to rehab. Not true. Not true at all. I never went to any of those places. I've taken people to the emergency room and to the psych wards that have voluntarily to go as a 12-step call, and I carry meetings into detox and to rehab because that's part of my 12-step work. I do it to jails and institutions because I love it. I love being able to carry the message. The book, they talk about the book being written in an eighth grade language, and I don't know about that. I was in the juvenile home in the eighth grade. Okay, I was in juvenile detention in the ninth grade. In the 10th grade, I was in a county jail. In the 11th grade, I was in a county jail. In the 12th grade, I was in a chain gang. I was sentenced to 52 years in a state penitentiary, and I was 18 years old because of what I did when I poured alcohol in my body. I had my first drink when I was 11, and it set off something in me that it doesn't set off in normal people. It set off a desire to get more. And every time I drank for the effect produced by alcohol, like the doctor says. So when I hear things, and I've got a sponsor that's 28 years that came from Scotland, and he had never gone to any of those places either, and he does not believe in anything but the words that are written in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's how I'm trained. I'm trained on what I learned. I didn't learn anything about 90 meetings in 90 days. My sponsor went to 90 meetings in 90 days, didn't drink for 90 days, and on the 91st day he drank, and he spent another 12 years going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, never having another 90 days. So when I hear 90 meetings in 90 days, I go, man, where is that in the book? When I hear meeting makers make it, meeting makers do not make it. They die of untreated alcoholism, and I have watched that in the past 11 years. Actually, I've been coming around for 15 years, so there was about a four-year span where I was coming in and out because of one thing. There was one thing that I could not admit. I was not crazy. And so when I'd look up at the board and I see the word restore me to sanity, that meant I was insane. And I have no doubt in my mind, I am not crazy. I'm not like you people. And then I would go and get drunk. You know? But I'm not like you people. I would come back and I would stop drinking. Because I just couldn't stand the pain. But I'm not like you people. I'm not crazy. and then I would go drink, and I would be drunk. And I repeated that, like it says in the book, over and over and over and over, until it got so bad that I almost killed myself the last time. And that's when I reached out, and that's when I got a sponsor who said, let's go through this book, and we're going to do what this book says. Okay? So, in a member's eye view, it's a pamphlet. I encourage everybody to get it. I love being here tonight because it's not like a regular meeting. It's not like an AA meeting where everybody's going to talk about their problem. You don't get to talk about anything. I get to talk about the problem. I know about the problem. That's why Rob said, hey, Jim, why don't you do the doctor's opinion? It's all about the problem. And I'm like, yeah, I can do that. But it's you all who have come out on a Friday night to come to a workshop are here for a reason. You're here either to further your education in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're here to learn if you're new, or you're here because this is what has saved your life and you're here tonight. It's not a group therapy meeting. And that's what a lot of AA meetings that I go to sometimes in my home group, I sit there and go, oh my God, we've turned into a group therapy, and we're not. You know, it's just I'm judgmental. Because I'm focused on what's in the book. So if I don't hear what's in the book, and I was mentioning the bird's eye, a member's eye view pamphlet, it says in there that when people say meeting makers make it, just go to meetings, it'll rub off on you. You'll get it by osmosis. And what that says in that pamphlet is what'll rub off on you is rigor mortis. And that's exactly what'll rub off. If you go to meetings and you don't follow the program, the plan of action is designed in this book that these people took in 1935 through 1939, and then they wrote about it. If you don't do this, and you're a real alcoholic like me, you're going to die. I mean, it says it in the book. It says it multiple times, for us to drink is to die. It tells me in the fourth step, if I don't do these things, if my actions continue to harm people, I'm going to drink. And for me to drink is to die. It tells me in the fifth step, if I don't do this, I may not overcome drinking. If I don't overcome drinking, for me to drink is to die. I believe what's in this book because I have living proof in my own family. I've buried both my brothers. One 10 years younger than me, one 4 years older than me because of untreated alcoholism. I know this book is talking to me tonight because I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be here. All right. We're going to go over the doctor's opinion, but before we do that, I always like to start with the last sentence in the forward to the third edition. And like I said, I've got a GED from the chain gang. 70 or below was failing. Okay? My highest score was in history. It was a 59. But I've got a number that says I've got an Orange County GED, and it's real. I got it with me because people asked to see it. And my highest score was a 59. God was doing for me in 1973 what I couldn't do for myself, and He continues to do that today. But the last sentence is, every day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And that's exactly what this program does. All right, if y'all would, we're going to jump over to the doctor's opinion, okay? And that's going to be on XXV or 25. Roman numeral 25. Now, last week Rob was talking about some words. And the first word of the doctor's opinion, well, first off, it's a doctor's opinion. That means it's not based on scientific fact. It originally was called the doctor's theory, and then they changed it before they put it in the book to the doctor's opinion. It still was not based on fact. It was based on what the doctor was observing when he was working with alcoholics. In the first book, the first printing of the first book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when they asked Dr. Silkworth, could they use some of his stuff? Could they have a letter from him? He said yes, on one condition. Anybody know what that is? You don't use my name. You don't use my name. Because he was afraid that he would be laughed out of or ostracized from the medical community if they used his name. In 1956 or 55, dates are pretty close, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association said that alcoholism is an illness, it is a disease. And so at the second printing of Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Silkworth said, you can use my name. Everybody else agrees with me, you can use my name now. In 1971, the World Health Organization agreed that alcoholism was a disease. In 1981, the United Kingdom agreed that alcoholism was a disease. You ready for this? In 1984, the United Kingdom that alcoholism is not a disease. And to this day, in England, alcohol is not recognized as a disease. Okay? The World Health Organization recognizes it, but for some reason, I'm not picking on the English, trust me, they already got picked on, they lost the war, but the bottom line is, they don't recognize it as a disease. And whatever the reason is, I don't have a clue. I just know there's some fact. All right, in the doctor's opinion, it starts with the very first word that Rob talked about last night. We of Alcoholics Anonymous. We. Underline that word. We. Because we're still talking about the first 100. Okay? We're still talking about the first 100 who got sober, who said, we want to put this thing together. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. The plan of recovery is the program. It is not the fellowship. We would not be here without the fellowship. The fellowship would not be here without the traditions. And Vic knows that as well as I do. We were going to chew our arms off in the early 40s because of our egos. And alcoholics who were getting sober were wanting to put so many rules and regulations on their groups that when they finally sent them all to New York, there were so many rules that nobody could get sober. And so that's why Bill was starting to write the traditions. That's why we have tradition three today. The only requirement is just a desire to stop drinking. You don't have to be sober. You don't have to stop drinking. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So we're here as a fellowship because of those traditions. That fellowship guided me to a book that has a plan of recovery, and it's described in the book. Now, it says right there that it talks about the well-known doctor, chief physician that Vic's already talked about, Dr. Silkworth. And he gave him this letter, and it says he specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In 34, he attended a patient, he's talking about Bill Wilson, and though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of the type I'd come to regard as hopeless. Alright, there's the first word. Underline that, circle it, do whatever you want with it. I was a hopeless alcoholic too. Okay? I think a lot of us were hopeless when we got here. We didn't come here on a winning streak. But a hopeless means there is no hope. We have no hope. And in 1939, there wasn't a cure for alcoholism. And in 2013, there's not a cure for alcoholism. You hear about it, somebody in California's got a pill, whatever. You know, there is not a cure. You know, what there is a daily reprieve. And it's based on a certain thing, and we'll find out about that in a minute. It says right, and I got to tell you, I got to be an alcoholic. I stopped to buy a bottle of water, and I paid 40 cents extra for a bottle of water that says Smart Water on it. I could have got it out of the tap, but no, I had to pay 40 cents more than a bottle of Zephyr Hills. In the course of Bill's third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his concept to other alcoholics, conceptions, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. And what's that? That's a 12th step, that we have to continue to carry this message to other alcoholics if we're going to keep it. You know, unheard of back in 39. You got to give something away to keep it? Paradoxes. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Now, last week Rob talked about the word recovered. You know, people kind of cringe at meetings when somebody says, I'm a recovered alcoholic. Recovered means to get well. It doesn't mean to be cured. And right there, that's the fourth time from the front page to right here, that's the fourth time. Recovered is used more in this book than recovery. Okay? They want to tell you that you can get well. Alright? They're not wanting to tell you that you're going to get healed. There's no way I'm going to get through this. Now, the doctor said he's personally known scores of cases who are the type of whom other methods had failed completely. Dr. Silkworth worked with about 50,000 alcoholics. The first 25,000 alcoholics he worked with, he had about a 2 to 4% success rate. And I call those 2 to 4% alcoholics abnormal because they got sober with no other help. Because he didn't know about the concept that we're about to talk about. Hundreds of people, thousands of people he worked with that couldn't get well. All right, we're going to jump to the last sentence of that very first thing. And I want you to know the small words or the doctor, the big words, which is follow this or them. And he says right here, you can rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. So what I say about other things doesn't really matter. It's my experience that you can rely on. What I tell you from my heart is what I'm telling you tonight, is I recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body because I followed the directions as outlined in a textbook called Alcoholics Anonymous. And a textbook is a book to be studied and referred back to. It's not a novel to be read through and then put aside. All right, the next thing is, the alcoholics then said, you know, at their request, the alcoholics, he gave us this letter. He's been kind enough to enlarge upon it and his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture. Now, if you haven't suffered alcoholic torture, maybe you've got some drinking left in you. I know what alcoholic torture is. It's in my mind and it's in my body. And that's what the doctor talks about. That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were a full flight from reality, or we were outright mental defectives. I did not like that when they told me that. I did not feel I was a mental defective, but I came to find out that I had a problem. And these things were true to some extent, in fact, to considerable extent with some of us. But we were sure that our bodies were sickened as well, not just our minds, because a long time ago, for a lot of time, everybody thought it was just a mental condition. It's all in your mind. Quit drinking. You can do it. You got willpower. You can quit drinking. They didn't know that alcoholics have a physical allergy to alcohol. And I'm going to get to that in a minute. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion to the soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation made good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account for. Okay? Though we work out our solution on a spiritual as well as an altruistic, which means other-centered, plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. Why? Alright, have you ever been on a 12-step call? Have you ever answered a 12-step hotline? Have you ever talked to a drunk when you're sober? How well do you get through to that drunk? How well do they understand they're killing themselves? Oh, no, I'm not. I just love this thing. I just have a small drinking problem, just a wee drinking problem. No, you're killing yourself. So we're not going to understand any of this stuff until our mind gets cleared. Right, and so hospitalization was a big thing back in the 30s. Detoxes are a big thing today. Emergency rooms are a big thing today. But if you just go to the emergency room and you dry out, or you just go to a 30-day detox and dry out, and you come out and you don't have anything to turn to, what are you going to do? What are you going to do when your emotions get to be so strong? What are you going to do when your problems pile up? You're going to drink. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pick up a drink because in my mind, it's going to tell me it's okay. This time it's going to be different. This time I'm not going to get drunk. Well, I got drunk every time I drank. I mean, there was nothing. So I did not get the pleasure of going to the emergency room or detox. What I got was to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and try to detox in the rooms. And you lovely people did not tell me to go to the hospital. You didn't tell me to go to detox. You didn't say get the hell out. You said, you need to quit drinking, Jim, so you can understand this program. And all I said was, I'm different. You know, I'm different. And so I continued to drink for almost 4 years. All right, so they asked him to write another letter. And now we're on XXVII, which is going to be 27. And the doctor writes, the subject presented in this book seemed to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years of experience as the medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country, treating alcoholic and drug addictions. I was a drug addict for many years. I put drugs down, I walked away from drugs. Okay? I was a drug addict. I watched a man die of heroin while I was doing heroin. I never did heroin again. Okay? I was an armed robber. I was a burglar. I broke into more Jack Eckert store than Jack Eckert did. I'm not proud of any of this, I guarantee you. But I did it for one reason. Vic just said it. I wanted to be in an altered state of mind 24 hours a day. I wanted to be high. You know? And most of the time I broke into Jack Eckert to steal the drugs to sell them for alcohol. So I was an alcoholic. you know, because I could put down drugs. I could not put down alcohol. You know, it was legal, as they say. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction to Dr. Silkworth when he's asked to contribute a few words on the subject, which is covered in masterly detail in the pages 1 through 164, and the doctor's opinion. And Dr. Bob's nightmare. I really have to emphasize that. You know, a lot of people say the stories in the back of the book are just stories. Stories in the back of the book are a speaker meeting in print. Every one of those stories, even though they've been changed, is a speaker meeting in print, and I love speaker meetings. I mean, I live on them. My sponsor has over 22,000 free speakers, and I'll tell you about that later on. But I have lived on speaker meetings because that has helped keep me sober. That has helped turn my life around. And I have a life today beyond my wildest dreams. And if you haven't brought your dreams to Alcoholics Anonymous yet, do it today. Bring your drunk dreams to AA and see what happens. All right, it says we, the third paragraph down, we again. Now, the Dr. Silkworth is talking about other doctors. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. Okay? They're medical doctors, and they're talking about moral psychology. Moral psychology is what? Spirituality. We are doctors, and we have a synthetic way of treating you. We have a man-made way of treating you. We do not have a spiritual way of treating you. All right? And so that's what he's saying right there. And that next paragraph says, it's outside of their synthetic knowledge. And it, next paragraph, many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book, Bill Wilson, came under his care in the hospital where he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. At once. And you will hear in this book a bunch of times about how long you should take before you take the steps. Sometimes it's immediately, sometimes it's right away, sometimes it's at once. Never does it say, take your time. There's a sign on the board that says, easy does it. That ain't about the steps. Okay, that's in a story in the back of the book. Okay, easy does it is not about taking the steps of recovery. The steps should be taken as fast as possible. And they should be taken with somebody who's taken the steps, with somebody who's got the book in their hand. And you should be taking the steps out of the book that's written. Okay? Every now and then I throw in a little bit of Jim, and I'm sorry, it says Jim sees it, but that's how, you know, I got sober. Okay, later Bill, it says, later Bill requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients at the hospital, and they gave him consent with some misgivings. But then they followed those cases, and they were interesting, and many of them were amazing. And what they found was the unselfishness of these men, who we've come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Chronic alcoholics. That's what I am. I'm a chronic alcoholic. I do it over and over and over and over and over. Alrighty. Why do I do it over and over and over? I don't know any other way to do it. I have to drink. Drinking always gave me an ease of comfort when I was young. Okay? And then drinking became my life. And then drinking was destroying me, and I didn't know what to do. And when I came in here, you people said, we have a plan. And I said, I'm different. All right? It took me a while. I want you to know, I'm just a little slow. You know, with a GED like I've got to be a little slow. All right, and then again it says, of course, the alcoholic will be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measure can be of maximum benefit. Now, when they first started putting people, I mean, Dr. Bob went to 6 dry out farms. Okay, that's what they were called back then. Most alcoholics were going to sanitariums. My mother was born in a place called Milledgeville, Georgia. And when my mother was born, Milledgeville was a state mental institution. Okay? I didn't know that. She never told me that. I found that out after she died. You know, after I came, well, actually, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know about Milledgeville. I knew about Chattahoochee, what Chattahoochee was. But Milledgeville was Georgia's Chattahoochee. And what happened was my mother was born in that town while my grandfather was in that mental institution for chronic alcoholism. Drying out. Come back out, go back home, start drinking, start the whole thing over again. But what they did in those drying out centers is they fed you three things. And this is what they found was the best thing to feed you when you were drying out for 5 to 6 days, because that's what they did. They fed you stewed tomatoes, they fed you sauerkraut, and they fed you Karo syrup. What? What's wrong with that? Karo syrup's got the sugar to replace the alcohol. Sauerkraut's got the protein in it. And stewed tomatoes, I'm pretty sure that's like belladonna's going to make you puke. I don't know why they did that, but they found like that was the thing to feed alcoholics for 5 to 7 days while they dragged you out. That would I should have gone to that place. That would have made me quit drinking. That's what I fit. No. No, I don't want that. All right. I'm getting ahead of myself. It's 8 o'clock. I promise to stay on time. And I really got to get through the doctor's opinion. So we're going to take a 10-minute break. We're going to come back at 10 after. I'm going to start at 10 after whether you're in here or not. So come back in 10 minutes. All right. I wasn't joking. I'm going to start. So you are in the room are going to get the wisdom of Jim Powers. As Jim says it, we believe is so suggested.
He wasn't kidding, was he?
10 after. Thank you, Bird. We believe is so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics was a manifestation of an allergy. Everybody know what an allergy is?
Yeah. A reaction to the substance.
Abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance. Abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance. Now I'm going to wait a couple minutes because they heard me outside. At least half of y'all left, so that's good. What?
I thought you might like to have that.
Yep, but I'm different. So you think you're different. A member's eye view of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a very great pamphlet. All right, so the doctor's talking about the doctors. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to my class, this class, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol. How? In any form. All right? Now, I know people who, if they go to a restaurant, specifically say, I cannot have any alcohol in clam sauce. You know, I cannot have any wine vinegar. And that is good. They are allergic. I don't go to restaurants. I don't ask for things like that. I just don't drink alcohol. I mean, that's how I do it. And it's going to tell me in a minute why. I can never use these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit, which I did, and found that I cannot break it, once having lost my self-confidence, the reliance upon human things. Things human, okay? So that means that my wife can't keep me from drinking. The judge can't keep me from drinking. When I was in the chain gang couldn't keep me from drinking. Why? Because I found a way to get off the chain gang and get into the kitchen, and we fed 150 people three meals a day, and I'm 18 years old, and I know how to make buck. And so I was able to take the ingredients that are in a kitchen, any kind of kitchen that feeds 150 people. You can find the ingredients. You can put them together. I used to tell this story and tell you what the ingredients are. You all are alcoholics. I'm not going to tell you how to go home and make the stuff. Trust me, yeast, sugar, syrup, and a few other ingredients. You can let it ferment for a couple weeks. You can hold your nose. You can drink it, and you can get the effect produced by alcohol. Okay? Having lost their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. All right? Here it is. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Anybody know what frothy emotional appeal is? Please don't drink anymore, Jim. Please, for God's sake, don't drink anymore. Or me looking at the mirror. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to drink anymore. I just want to have a couple drinks. I'm so worked up about this drinking problem. I got to have a couple drinks to calm down so I can think about not drinking anymore. Frothy emotional appeal does not get it. Okay? The message which can interest and hold these alcoholics like me must have depth and weight. So this book that they're going to start telling us about, this textbook, has to have depth and weight. Right? In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. Now, throughout the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you are going to see how Bill does this. He is going to tell you a problem, and really quick afterwards, he is going to tell you a solution. He is going to tell me that I'm powerless over alcohol, and that my life when I drink alcohol is unmanageable, because that's what I read all those years that I was coming in and out. I read that when I drink alcohol, my life is unmanageable. That step does not say that. It says my life, managed by me, is unmanageable. And I'm going to have to find a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And I'm not talking about insane asylums. I'm talking about the insanity that comes from an obsession of the mind. The insanity of thinking I'm different. And the guy handed me a pamphlet, and I thank him very much. Do you think you're different? Yes, I do. And let me have a drink and show you, right? You do not want to see me drinking. All right. So, it's got to have depth and weight if we're going to do what? We're going to recreate our lives. All right? My life is out of control. It's unmanageable by me. I need a new life. I need a power greater than myself. That is what this book is going to teach me to do. It says in the book, lack of power was my dilemma. Yeah, I had to find a power greater than myself. But how am I going to do that? And then it goes on to say, that's exactly what this book's written for, is to show me how to find a power that can solve my problems. I always read my alcohol problems. It doesn't say my alcohol problems. It says my problems. So the power that I found, which everybody's got to find their own, I've got my own, and it's a personal one, but the power I found can solve all my problems if I let that power take control. If I take control, I'm going to pick up a drink. All right. He goes on to say that, you know, if you don't believe them, go watch them. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children, all the things that alcoholics do and don't care they're doing, because we got to have that drink. We got to have that ease and comfort that comes from the first few drinks. But it's not ease and comfort. It's not. Not when you get to my stage. Not when I'm driving to the liquor store after 90 days of not having a drink, and I've decided, okay, I'm feeling great, I'm doing great, I'm driving to the liquor store. It's in my mind. My obsession is kicked in. My obsession that blocks out any other conscious thought. My obsession is, I'm going to have a drink, and I'm driving to the liquor store. Do you know what I have? I have ease and comfort, because I'm on my way to the liquor store. Before I ever swallow the first drop of alcohol, Jim has ease and comfort because he knows it's coming. My problems are going to go away. Everything's going to be okay. No, my problems aren't going to go away. They're going to pile up and they're going to be so difficult I can never solve them. Because that's what the book tells me. All right. He feels after many years of experience that he found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men and women. And I'm saying women, I'm adding a word because it's men and women. When they wrote this book, there was only a couple of women, and the first women were not sponsored by alcoholics. Do you know that? The first women in Alcoholics Anonymous were sponsored by the wives of alcoholics. And Dr. Bob was panicked about you women coming into our fellowship. You know that? Dr. Bob was the one who wanted to keep women out of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was so afraid what was going to happen. And so Lois and Ann and some of the other wives were the first sponsors. The first sponsor in New York, the first woman sponsor in New York was called Mann, Marty Mann. She got sober because she would not leave Bill Wilson's meeting. She insisted she was an alcoholic. They let her stay, and every woman that came in for the next 18 months, Marty Band sponsored. You know that? I didn't until I studied it. All right, here we are down here at the bottom of that page, right? Men and women, and we're talking about chronic alcoholics, right? Men and women drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. The cessation is so elusive that while they admit it's killing me, I'll admit it's killing me, injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. Vic talked about that a minute ago. He talked about denial. I know it's killing me, but I'm not going to admit it. I'm going to keep denying that it's killing me because I got to have it. I got to have it because my mind says I can't live life without it. And once I put it, people say I'm craving a drink. When you're not drinking, you're not craving a drink. Dr. Bob even said at the end, in his, he was craving a drink for 2 years after he stopped drinking. He was not craving a drink. He said he was. He was wanting a drink. He was thinking about a drink. He was obsessing about a drink, but he wasn't taking the action that required to take that drink. He wasn't buying a bottle. He wasn't drinking it. Craving comes from putting alcohol in your body. It comes after you take the first drink, is when the allergy is set off in your body and you become craving for that next drink. And you continue to drink until you do what? Until you either black out, pass out, get arrested, or get killed. Okay? So I can't tell the difference between the true and false. That means I'm a liar or I'm in denial. To me, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I've been doing it so long, it's got to be the only normal one. I am restless, irritable, and discontent unless I can again experience the ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which I see other people taking with impunity. That means without trouble. I see these other people drinking a couple drinks. They have dinner. They do homework with the kids. They go to bed. What the hell's wrong with them? You know? Two drinks, they're feeling tipsy, right? Two drinks, my craving's set off. I got to have another drink. Two drinks to them, it's a depressant. They're going to go to sleep. Two drinks to me is a stimulant. I want four more, and now I'm going to get the hell up and I'm going to go out and do something crazy. I'm going to get behind the wheel of a car. Now, I did not plan when I picked up that drink that I'm going to get behind the wheel of a car and kill somebody. I didn't plan that. You just don't plan those things. Prisons are full of people who did not plan on committing vehicular homicide. But once that drink takes a hold and that craving starts, they can't differentiate the true from the false. They know they shouldn't be driving. I know I shouldn't be behind the wheel. You know, I've never been convicted of DUI. I was arrested 4 times before I was 21 years old for DUI. And now I'm going to tell you, I was lying earlier. I am older than Rob. Because when I got arrested my first time, I didn't blow in the machine. And that was back in the late 60s. And at that time, you had a 30-day suspended license. The second time I didn't blow in the machine, it was a 90 days. The third time, it was a 90-day suspension of my license. Did I stop driving because I didn't have a license? No, I did not. You know, I continued to drive. I didn't get caught. The fourth DUI, I got an attorney. And I got it reduced to a careless driving. And that's what they were allowed to do back in the late 60s, early 70s. You know what the average cost of first DUI right now? There you go. Just pick a number. Pick a number. What attorney did you hire? Pick a number. You know? It's way more than it cost me, I can tell you that. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent until I can have a drink. All right, or with me until I'm going to get a drink. And then I have that ease and comfort. The ease and comfort that other people have, okay? Now here it comes. There was the problem right there. There was the problem right there. We drink because we like the effect. I need to have it because I've got a craving that has to be solved. And here it comes. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, my ex-wife didn't understand. My family didn't understand. The judge never understood. They were not alcoholics. They didn't understand. Those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, and that word is interchange with spiritual experience. Psychic change and spiritual experience mean the exact same thing. A rearrangement of the way I think. A change in my actions based on a change in my thought. And that comes from the spiritual appendix in the back of the book. Once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed. I am doomed. That is not a very good word. Mental defective and doomed. I don't like either one of them. There's not a whole lot of wiggle room there. Who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself, underline these two words, easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary being required to follow a few simple rules. All right? This is a doctor. This is a not-alcoholic. And he's telling me there's rules. And that's okay. Because if you're telling me there's rules, I'm not coming back. What you told me is we suggest these steps. I'm sorry, that's crap. I don't suggest a step to anybody. I said, if you want to stay sober, this is what you're going to do. Because I'm going to show you this is what I did. I can't tell you what to do. Here it is right here. This tells me what to do. All right? I have to show somebody what to do. Bless you.
Thank you.
So the doctor's saying that we've got to follow a few simple rules. What are those rules? Anybody know?
12
steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he goes on to talk about how they cry out to him so many times that it can't stop. You got to help him. And faced with the problem, the doctor is honest with himself. He can't do it. He is inadequate. And once one feels that sometimes more than a human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. More than a human power, God, as you understand him, to get a spiritual experience. No human power can keep me away from alcohol. Not yesterday, not 11 years ago, not 15 years ago, not an hour ago. There is no human power in this world that can keep me from taking a drink. I rely on my higher power. All right. I'm going to jump a page, right, real quick. We're going to go to XXX. That's 30. That's not porno. And we're going to go down. We're going to go real quick before I give it back to Vic. We're going to go through five classifications, all right? The second paragraph. The classification of alcohol seems most difficult, and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. So we're saying that the book, even at the end of the book, it says the book's meant to be suggestive only. They're saying that there's other ways. You know, don't close your mind to all spiritual concepts. It says that in the spiritual appendix. What they're saying is, this is working. And so they're going to print it, and they're going to use it, and this is going to be our guide. Okay? But there's other ways. You know, I had a guy say, there's no wrong way to stay sober. And I said, I don't know any other way but this book. And he said, that's the right way. Alright? Alright, so we're going to go through five ways. Alright, five alcoholics. First one. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. And we're all familiar with that type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They're over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never what? A decision. You ever hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, take it easy, just calm down, you know, don't make any major decisions in the first year? My guys are making a major decision in the second week. If they're working this book with me in the second week, we are in the third step. And if you don't think that's a major decision, excuse me? All right. They're over-remorseful, making resolutions, but never a decision. Number two, there's a type of man who's unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. That's more about alcoholism, switching from brandy to scotch, drinking on the job, never taking a trip, whatever. I drank. Changes his brand or his environment. Number three, there's the type who always believes that after entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can drink without danger. Okay? There's the guy who stops drinking in the book. He doesn't drink for 25 years. He retires. Takes out his slippers, takes out the bottle. 4 years, he's dead. His name's Fred, if you haven't read that story yet. Number four, there's the manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. The manic depressive wants the whole book written about him. I'm sorry, they do. Now here's me, okay? Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect, okay? Except the effect alcohol has on them. They're often able, intelligent, and friendly people. That is me. You know? That's who I remember. I'm different. Okay. So, but all these and many others, so they just listed five right there. I gave you five. The doctor gave us five. All these and many others have one symptom in common. That means that me, the able, intelligent, friendly guy, has the same thing in common as that psychopath? As that manic depressive? Come on. We've got the same thing. We have one symptom in common. We cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. And that phenomenon, as we suggest, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart from other people. So, abnormal drinkers. 10 people take a drink. One person has to have another drink, has to have another drink, has to have another drink. That is the abnormal drinker. That is the alcoholic. The other 9 are normal people. I'm abnormal. I can't take one drink. Okay? And at the bottom of that page, it goes, much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, who he's talking about, the general opinion seems that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. There's that word doomed again. I'm doomed, all right? Now the next page. What is solution? What is the solution, all right? And then he goes on to outline what the solution is. And the solution is going to be in step 2. And he talks about the guy who, you know, he accepted the plan outlined in this book. That's in that first paragraph about 3/4 of the way down on the right. He accepted the plan of recovery. Not the fellowship, not your word. He accepted the plan as outlined in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. All right. I've already taken up more than Vic's time than he wanted me to, so I'm going to give it back over to Vic, and then I'll come back in a few minutes. All right, we've got about 12 minutes, and I'm going to be speaking in real fast. All right, 2 things I want to go over. Allergy, abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance, and the obsession, which is a thought or idea that overrides all contrary thoughts or ideas. A thought or idea that overrides all contrary thoughts. An adolescent person can experience an entire psychic change. That is step 2. So what we're talking about is the problem, the solution. And throughout the book, I said, you're going to be hearing about the problem and the solution. And the last thing that Dr. Silkwork talks about was that he earnestly advises every alcoholic to read this book through, and though they came to scoff, he may remain to pray, which is a pretty good thing. Now, Bill talks about a lot of things in the first couple of pages. He talks about coming back from the war. He talks about how he was going to be rich. You know, he talks about a couple of things. He talks about drinking when things are great. He talks about drinking when things are terrible. Okay? And anybody in this room kind of associate with that? Mm-hmm. Okay. Everybody, that good. I'm glad we're alcoholics then. And he says on page 3 that he assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night, that he became a lone wolf drinker. And if we jump over to page 5, down towards the second paragraph, it's real quick. It says, gradually things got worse. You know, he lost the house. Mother-in-law died. Father-in-law became ill. And he went back, and it's 32, okay? He's at his low point. Stocks are crashing. And then he got a good idea, and before he got the chance to go out and do that good idea, he got drunk, okay? And he woke up, and this had to be stopped, he said. I saw that I could not so much as take one drink. I was through forever. And so I did. He meant business. That is self-will, is what Bill's explaining right there. Because the next sentence says, shortly afterwards, I came home drunk. Someone had pushed a drink my way. Didn't say he pushed it down his mouth. It just said, have a drink. He's on the way to the golf course, and it was Armistice Day. All right, page 6. You know, once again, you know, he's laughing at the gin mills, and now he walks in to a cafe, to telephone, and what's he do? He picks up a drink. Again, all right? And then that paragraph, the first paragraph, here it is. Here's a bottom, if I've ever heard one described. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning was unforgettable. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning was unforgettable. The impending calamity that he knew was going to happen. He couldn't walk across the street. This is 1932. This is Bill's bottom. This is it, right? Look at the bottom of that paragraph. Well, no, not now. Gin will fix this problem that's unforgettable. So two bottles in oblivion. And then, you know, I'm an EMT, so this is absolutely true. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms because his endured this bottom day and night for two more years. It was December of 1934 when Bill had his last drink. Two more years of remorse, horror, and hopelessness that he couldn't forget the next day. And yet, a couple bottles of gin will make me forget. All right? So then came the night when the physical and mental torture. Physical and mental torture were so hellish that he feared that he'd burst through the window. But what did he do? He called the doctor. The doctor came over, gave him a little bit of Benadryl, or gave him a little bit of codeine. Mine was codeine and alcohol that produced me peeing in the bed. So I loved that. And so he kept drinking both gin and sedatives. Now, you always hear about Bill and Bob both being, they were both. You know, drugs, a drug is a drug. Okay, so what? You know, I'm not going to debate that, all right? They both did sedatives, they both did alcohol, they both mixed them. The reason the Washingtonian Society didn't make it, the reason the Emanuel Society in the late 1800s didn't make it, the reason the Oxford Society, the Oxford Group didn't make it, is because they didn't have what? They didn't have a singleness of purpose. It's a tradition, but I'm very strong on the singleness of purpose. When I do an AA talk, I don't talk about drugs, but very briefly. It's always open meetings, and I'll talk about a little bit of my drug use. When I go into the jails and I do a talk in jail, my drug use comes out tremendously because 99% of those people are in there because of drugs. It's not alcohol nowadays. It's drugs. It's pill, crack, and things like that. All right, the body is taking it for two more years. And the doctor came, gave him gin and sedatives, he's drinking gin and sedatives, and it landed him on the rocks, okay? Now, the next paragraph, you know, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, the allergy and the obsession. And so, you know, he stopped drinking, and the goose held high or hung high, whatever. Self-knowledge was Bill's answer at that point in time. Whoops, sorry. Next sentence is, but it was not. Because there it is, he drank again. And that's my story. Over and over and over. And it shows down there that his wife, Lois, was told that he would wind up with either heart failure from the DTs. Anybody ever see anybody going in the DTs? Anybody ever been in the DTs? It is hell. It is scary. Or he's going to develop something called cyberpsychosis, which is wet brain syndrome. You are just a walking zombie. You've seen one flew over the cuckoo's nest, walking around with a front-end lobotomy? That's what a wet brain looks like. If you've never been to the emergency room or someplace like that, take a trip. Don't take a trip. Whatever. I thought when they said that they were talking about doing acid. I don't know why. Taking a trip? Yeah, I did that. Not taking a trip. Okay, I did that too. So anyway, we get to page 8, all right? And this is where I am going to end up. All right, it says that once again when he's drinking, the second paragraph, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Oh my God, I drank again. How could I do that? Well, because I didn't have a solution. I had no solution to drinking. I stopped drinking. I came to meetings. I said, God, please keep me away from a drink, and he did. And then the time came where I drank because I had no solution. The time will come in every alcoholic where no human power can keep me away from a drink. If I don't have a solution in step 2, if I don't have a solution, I'm going to drink. And if I drink, I'm going to hurt somebody. Alcohol was his master. All right? Now, the words that Bill used in the first, you know, part of this book, they're real important. Because when he used words like all, he means all. When he says master, that means it controlled him and he had nothing to say about it. He was under its lash, the lash of alcoholism. Fear sobered me a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of the first drink, and he was off again. Now, the previous page, he hit his bottom, and he drank again. He was soon, and that's the problem right there, in that paragraph right there is a problem, okay? Fear sobered him a bit, and then he drank. And here's the solution. How dark it was before the dawn, in reality, that was the beginning of his last debacle. I was soon to be catapulted in what he liked to call the fourth dimension of existence. You hear the ninth step promises read all the time? They're promises all through the book before you get to the ninth step. They're called the ninth step promises because you're at the ninth step. All right? We're at the first step. We are at the first step. Here's a promise. I was to know a new happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. That is a promise. Okay? So don't just think there's only one set of promises in the book. They are all throughout the book. People sometimes call it a threat. For me to drink is to die is a promise. It's not a threat. I thank you all for bearing with me tonight. Thank you.